and memorizing the code. It seemed like an unnecessary precaution. If they could remember the code, they wouldn't need to be here, would they? I don't know if you've experienced this yet with your parent, but wandering and nighttime restlessness are very common behaviors with Alzheimer's. Our unit allows the residents to wander about at any time, but safely and without the risk of getting lost. We don't tranquilize them at night or restrict them to their rooms. We try to help them maintain as much freedom and independence as possible. It's something we know is important to them and to their families. A small, white-haired woman in a pink and green floral housecoat confronted Alice. "You're not my daughter." "No, sorry, I'm not." "Give me back my money." "She didn't take your money, Evelyn. Your money's in your room. Check your top dresser drawer. I think you put it there." The woman eyed Alice with suspicion and disgust, but then followed the advice of authority and shuffled in her dirty white terry cloth slippers back into her room. She has a $20 bill she keeps hiding because she's worried someone will steal it. Then, of course, she forgets where she put it and accuses everyone of taking it. We've tried to get her to spend it or put it in the bank, but she won't. At some point, she'll forget she owns it, and that'll be the end of it. Safe from Evelyn's paranoid investigation, they proceeded unimpeded to a common room at the end of the hallway. The room was populated with elderly people eating lunch at round tables. Upon taking a closer look, Alice realized that the room was filled with elderly women. "There are only 3 men?" "Actually, only 2 out of our 32 residents are men. Harold comes every day to eat meals with his wife." Perhaps reverting to the cootie rules of childhood, the 2 men with Alzheimer's disease sat together at their own table, apart from the women. Walkers crowded the spaces between the tables. Many of the women sat in wheelchairs. Most everyone had thinning white hair and sunken eyes magnified behind thick glasses, and they all ate in slow motion. There was no socializing, no conversation, not even between Harold and his wife. The only sounds other than the noises of eating came from a woman who sang while she ate, her internal needle skipping on the title line of "By the Light of the Silvery Moon," over and over. No one protested or applauded. As you might have guessed, this is our dining and activities room. Residents have breakfast, lunch, and dinner here at the same times every day. Predictable routines are important. Activities are here as well. There's bowling and beanbag toss, trivia, dancing and music, and crafts. They made these adorable birdhouses this morning. And we have someone read the newspaper to them every day to keep them up on current events. There's plenty of opportunity for our residents to keep their bodies and minds as engaged and enriched as possible. And family members and friends are always welcome to come and participate in any of the activities and can join their loved one for any of the meals. Aside from Harold, Alice saw no other loved ones. No other husbands, no wives, no children or grandchildren, no friends. We also have a highly trained medical staff should any of our residents require additional care. Do you have any residents here under the age of 60? Oh no, the youngest is, I think, 70. The average age is about 82, 83. It's rare to see someone with Alzheimer's younger than 60. You're looking at one right now, lady. How much does all of this cost? I can give you a packet of information on the way out, but as of January, the Alzheimer's special care unit rate runs at $285 a day. Alice did the rough math in her head. About $100,000 a year. Multiply that by 5, 10, 20 years. Can I answer anything else for you? No, thanks. She followed her tour guide back to the locked double doors and watched her type in the code. 079-1925. She didn't belong here. It was the rarest of days in Cambridge, the kind of mythical day that New Englanders dreamed about, but each year came to doubt the true existence of. A sunny, 70-degree spring day. A Crayola blue sky, finally don't need a coat spring day. A day not to be wasted sitting in an office, especially if you had Alzheimer's. She deviated a couple of blocks southeast of the yard and walked into Ben and Jerry's with the giddy thrill of a teenager playing hooky. "I'll have a triple scoop peanut butter cup and a cone, please." "Hell, I'm on Lipitor." She beheld her giant, heavy cone as if it were an Oscar, paid with a $5 bill, dropped the change in the tips for college jar, and continued on toward the Charles River. She'd converted to frozen yogurt, a supposedly healthier alternative, many years ago, and had forgotten how thick and creamy and purely enjoyable ice cream was. She thought about what she had just seen at the Mount Auburn Manor Nursing Center as she licked and walked. She needed a better plan, one that didn't include her playing beanbag toss with Evelyn in the Alzheimer's special care unit. One that didn't cost John a fortune to keep alive and safe a woman who no longer recognized him, and who, in the most important ways, he didn't recognize either. She didn't want to be here at that point, when the burdens, both emotional and financial, grossly outweighed any benefit of sticking around. She was making mistakes and struggling to compensate for them, but she felt sure that her IQ still fell at least a standard deviation above the mean. And people with average IQs didn't kill themselves. Well, some did, but not for reasons having to do with IQ. Despite the escalating erosion of her memory, her brain still served her well in countless ways. For example, at this very moment, she ate her ice cream without dripping any of it onto the cone or her hand by using a lick-and-turn technique that had become automatic to her as a child, and was probably stored somewhere near the information for how to ride a bike and how to tie a shoe. Meanwhile, she stepped off the curb and crossed the street, her motor cortex and cerebellum solving the complex mathematical equations necessary to move her body to the other side without falling over or getting hit by a passing car. She recognized the sweet smell of narcissus and a brief waft of curry emanating from the Indian restaurant on the corner. With each lick, she savored the delicious tastes of chocolate and peanut butter, demonstrating the intact activation of her brain's pleasure pathways, the same ones required for enjoying sex or a good bottle of wine. But at some point, she would forget how to eat an ice cream cone, how to tie her shoe, and how to walk. At some point, her pleasure neurons would become corrupted by an onslaught of aggregating amyloid, and she'd no longer be capable of enjoying the things she loved. At some point, there would simply be no point. She wished she had cancer instead. She'd trade Alzheimer's for cancer in a heartbeat. She felt ashamed for wishing this, and it was certainly a pointless bargaining, but she permitted the fantasy anyway. With cancer, she'd have something she could fight. There was surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. There was the chance that she could win. Her family and the community at Harvard would rally behind her battle and consider it noble. And even if defeated in the end, she'd be able to look them knowingly in the eye and say goodbye before she left. Alzheimer's disease was an entirely different kind of beast. There were no weapons that could slay it. Taking Aricept and Namenda felt like aiming a couple of leaky squirt guns in the face of a blazing fire. John continued to probe into the drugs and clinical development, but she doubted that any of them were ready and capable of making a significant difference for her, else he would already have been on the phone with Dr. Davis, insisting on a way to get her on them. Right now, everyone with Alzheimer's faced the same outcome, whether they were 82 or 50, resident of the Mount Auburn Manor or full professor of psychology at Harvard University. The blazing fire consumed all. No one got out alive. And while a bald head and a looped ribbon were seen as badges of courage and hope, her reluctant vocabulary and vanishing memories advertised mental instability and impending insanity. Those with cancer could expect to be supported by their community. Alice expected to be outcast. Even the well-intentioned and educated tended to keep a fearful distance from the mentally ill. She didn't want to become someone people avoided and feared. Accepting the fact that she did indeed have Alzheimer's, that she could only bank on two unacceptably effective drugs available to treat it, and that she couldn't trade any of this in for some other curable disease. What did she want? Assuming the in vitro procedure worked, she wanted to live to hold Anna's baby and know it was her grandchild. She wanted to see Lydia act in something she was proud of. She wanted to see Tom fall in love. She wanted one more sabbatical year with John. She wanted to read every book she could before she could no longer read. She laughed a little, surprised at what she'd just revealed to herself. Nowhere in that list was there anything about linguistics, teaching, or Harvard. She ate her last bite of cone. She wanted more sunny 70-degree days and ice cream cones. And when the burden of her disease exceeded the pleasure of that ice cream, she wanted to die. But would she quite literally have the presence of mind to recognize it when those curves crossed? She worried that the future her would be incapable of remembering and executing this kind of plan. Asking John or any of her children to assist her with this in any way was not an option. She'd never put any of them in that position. She needed a plan that committed the future her to a suicide she arranged for now. She needed to create a simple test, one that she could self-administer every day. She thought about the questions Dr. Davis and the neuropsychologist had asked her, the ones she already couldn't answer last December. She thought about what she still wanted. Intellectual brilliance wasn't required for any of them. She was willing to go on living with some serious holes in short-term memory. She removed her BlackBerry from her baby blue Anna William bag, a birthday gift from Lydia. She wore it every day, slung over her left shoulder, resting on her right hip. It had become an indispensable accessory, like her platinum wedding ring and running watch. It looked great with her butterfly necklace. It contained her cell phone, her BlackBerry, and her keys. She took it off only to sleep. She typed, "Alice, answer the following questions. 1. What month is it? 2. Where do you live? 3. Where is your office? 4. When is Anna's birthday? 5. How many children do you have?" If you have trouble answering any of these, go to the file named Butterfly on your computer and follow the instructions there immediately. She set the alarm to vibrate and to appear as a recurring reminder every morning on her appointment calendar at 8 o'clock, no end date. She realized that there were a lot of potential problems with this design, that it was by no means foolproof. She just hoped she opened Butterfly before she became that fool. She practically ran to class, worried that she was most certainly late, but nothing had started without her when she got there. She took an aisle seat, 4 rows back, left of center. A few students trickled in through the doors at the back of the room, but for the most part the class was there, ready. She looked at her watch. 10:05. The clock on the wall agreed. This was most unusual. She kept herself busy. She looked over the syllabus and skimmed her notes from last class. She made a to-do list for the rest of the day. Lab, seminar, run, study for final. Time, 10:10. She tapped her pen to the tune of My Sharona. The students stirred, becoming restless. They checked notebooks and the clock on the wall. They flipped through textbooks and shut them. They booted up laptops and clicked and typed. They finished their coffees. They crinkled wrappers belonging to candy bars and chips and various other snacks and ate them. They chewed pen caps and fingernails. They twisted their torsos to search the back of the room. They leaned to consult friends in other rows. They raised eyebrows and shrugged shoulders. They whispered and giggled. "Maybe it's a guest lecturer," said a girl who sat a couple of rows behind Alice. Alice unfolded her motivation and emotion syllabus again. Tuesday, May 4th. Stress, helplessness, and control. Chapters 12 and 14. Nothing about a guest lecturer. The energy in the room converted from expectant to awkward dissonance. They were like corn kernels on a hot stove. Once that first one popped, the rest would follow, but no one knew which one would be first or when. The formal rule at Harvard stated that students were required to wait 20 minutes for a tardy professor before the class was officially canceled. Unafraid of going first, Alice closed her notebook, capped her pen, and slid everything into her book bag. 10:21. Long enough. As she turned to leave, she looked at the four girls who sat behind her. They all looked up at her and smiled, probably grateful to her for releasing the pressure and setting them free. She held up her wrist, displaying the time as her irrefutable data. "I don't know about you guys, but I have better things to do." She walked up the stairs and exited the auditorium through the back doors and never looked back. She sat in her office and watched the shiny rush hour traffic creep along Memorial Drive. Her hip vibrated. It was 8 a.m. She removed her BlackBerry from her baby blue bag. "Alice, answer the following questions. 1. What month is it? 2. Where do you live? 3. Where is your office? 4. When is Anna's birthday? 5. How many children do you have?" If you have trouble answering any of these, go to the file named Butterfly on your computer and follow the instructions there immediately. May, 34 Poplar Street, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02138. William James Hall, room 1002. September 14th, 1976. 3. June 2004. An unmistakably elderly woman with hot pink nails and lips tickled a little girl, about 5 years old, presumably the woman's granddaughter. Both looked to be having a grand old time. The advertisement read, "The number one tummy tickler takes the number one prescribed Alzheimer's drug." Alice had been flipping through Boston Magazine, but was unable to move past this page. A hatred of that woman and the ad filled her like a hot liquid. She studied the picture and the words, waiting for her thoughts to catch up to what her gut understood. But before she could figure out why she felt so personally antagonized, Dr. Moyer opened the door to the examining room. "So, Alice, I see you're having some difficulty sleeping. Tell me what's going on." "It's taking me well over an hour to get to sleep, and then I usually wake up a couple of hours after that and go through the whole thing all over again." "Are you experiencing any hot flashes or physical discomfort at bedtime?"
"No."
"What medications are you taking?"
"Aricept, Namenda, Lipitor, vitamin C and E, and aspirin."
"Well, unfortunately, insomnia can be a side effect of the Aricept."
"Right, but I'm not going off Aricept."
"Tell me what you do when you can't get to sleep."
"Mostly I lie there and worry. I know this is going to get a lot worse, but I don't know when, and I worry that I might go to sleep and wake up the next morning and not know where I am or who I am or what I do. I know it's irrational, but I have this idea that the Alzheimer's can only kill off my brain cells when I'm asleep, and that as long as I'm awake and sort of on watch, I'll stay the same. I know all this anxiety keeps me up, but I can't seem to help it. As soon as I can't fall asleep, I worry. And then I can't sleep because I'm worried. It's exhausting just telling you about it." Only some of what she just said was true. She did worry, but she'd been sleeping like a baby.
"Are you overcome with this kind of anxiety at any other time of the day?" asked Dr. Moyer.
"No."
"I could prescribe you an SSRI. I don't want to go on an antidepressant. I'm not depressed." The truth was, she might be a little depressed. She'd been diagnosed with a fatal, incurable illness. So had her daughter. She'd almost entirely stopped traveling. Her once dynamic lectures had become unbearably boring. And even on the rare occasion when he was home with her, John seemed a million miles away. So yes, she was a little sad. But that seemed an appropriate response, given the situation,
and not a reason to add yet another medication, with more side effects, to her daily intake. And it wasn't what she'd come here for. We could try you on Restoril, one each night at bedtime. It'll get you to sleep quickly and allow you to stay asleep for about 6 hours, and you shouldn't wake up groggy in the morning. I'd like something stronger. There was a long pause. I think I'd like you to make an appointment to come back in with your husband, and we can talk about prescribing something stronger. This doesn't concern my husband. I'm not depressed, and I'm not desperate. I'm aware of what I'm asking for, Tamara. Dr. Moyer studied her face carefully. Alice studied hers. They were both older than 40, younger than old, both married, highly educated professional women. Alice didn't know her doctor's politics. She'd see another doctor if she had to. Her dementia was going to get worse. She couldn't risk waiting any longer. She might forget. She had rehearsed additional dialogue but didn't need to use it. Dr. Moyer got out her prescription pad and began to write. She was back in that tiny testing room with Sarah something, the neuropsychologist. She'd reintroduced herself to Alice just a moment ago, but Alice had promptly forgotten her last name. Not a good omen. The room, however, was as she remembered it from January, cramped, sterile, and impersonal. It contained one desk with an iMac computer on it, two cafeteria chairs, and a metal file cabinet. Nothing else. No windows, no plants, no pictures or calendar on the walls or desk. No distractions, no possible hints, no chance associations. Sarah something began with what felt almost like regular conversation. Alice, how old are you? 50. When did you turn 50? October 11th. In what time of year is this? Spring, but it already feels like summer. I know, it's hot out there today. And where are we right now? In the Memory Disorders Unit at Mass General Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. Can you name the four things shown in this picture? A book, a phone, a horse, and a car. And what is this thing on my shirt? A button. And this thing on my finger? A ring. Can you spell water backwards for me? R-E-T-A-W. And repeat this after me. Who, what, when, where, why? Who, what, when, where, why? Can you lift your hand, close your eyes, and open your mouth? She did. Alice, what were those four objects in the picture you named before? A horse, a car, a phone, and a book. Great, and write a sentence for me here. I cannot believe that I won't be able to do this someday. Great, now name for me as many words as you can in a minute that begin with the letter S. Sarah, something, stupid, sound, survive, sick, sex, serious, something, oops, I said that, said, scared. Now name as many words as you can that begin with the letter F. Forget, forever, fun, fight, flight, fit, fuck. She laughed, surprised at herself. Sorry about that one. Sorry begins with S. That's okay, I get that one a lot. Alice wondered how many words she would have been able to rattle off a year ago. She wondered how many words per minute were considered normal. Now name as many vegetables as you can. Asparagus, broccoli, cauliflower, leeks, onion, pepper. Pepper, I don't know, I can't think of any more. Last one, name as many animals with four legs as you can. Dogs, cats, lions, tigers, bears, zebras, giraffes, gazelle. Now read this sentence aloud for me. Sarah something handed her a sheet of paper. On Tuesday, July 2nd, in Santa Ana, California, a wildfire shut down John Wayne Airport, stranding 30 travelers, including 6 children and 2 firemen, Alice read. It was an NYU story, a test of declarative memory performance. Now tell me as many details as you can about the story you just read. On Tuesday, July 2nd, in Santa Ana, California, a fire stranded 30 people in an airport, including 6 children and 2 firemen. Great. Now I'm going to show you a series of pictures on cards, and you're going to just tell me the names of them. The Boston Naming Exam. Briefcase, pinwheel, telescope, igloo, hourglass, rhinoceros, a 4-legged animal. Racket. Oh, wait, I know what it is. It's a ladder for plants. A lattice? No, a trellis. Accordion, pretzel, rattle. Oh, wait again. We have one in our yard at the Cape. It's between the trees. You lie on it. It's not a hanger. It's a halyard? No. Oh, God, it begins with H, but I can't get it. Sarah something made a notation on her score sheet. Alice wanted to argue that her omission could just as easily have been a normal case of blocking as a symptom of Alzheimer's. Even perfectly healthy college students typically experienced 1 to 2 tips of the tongue per week. That's okay, let's keep going. Alice named the rest of the pictures without further difficulties, but she still couldn't activate the neuron that encoded the missing name of the napping net. Theirs hung between 2 spruce trees in their yard in Chatham. Alice remembered many late afternoon naps there with John. The pleasure of the breezy shade, the intersection of his chest and shoulder her pillow, the familiar scent of their fabric softener on his cotton shirt, combined with the summer smells of his sunburned and ocean-salty skin intoxicating her every inhalation. She could remember all of that, but not the name of the damn H thing they lay on. She sailed through the WACE-R picture arrangement test, Raven's colored progressive matrices, the Luria mental rotation test, the Stroop test, in copying and remembering geometric figures. She checked her watch. She'd been in that little room for just over an hour. Okay, Alice, now I'd like you to think back to that short story you read earlier. What can you tell me about it? She swallowed her panic, and it lodged, heavy and hulking, right above her diaphragm, making it uncomfortable to breathe. Either her pathways to the details of the story were impassable, or she lacked the electrochemical strength to knock loudly enough on the neurons housing them to be heard. Outside of this closet, she could look up lost information in her BlackBerry. She could reread her emails and write herself reminders on post-it notes. She could rely on the default respect her Harvard position embodied. Outside of this little room, she could hide her impassable pathways and wimpy neural signals. And although she knew that these tests were designed to unveil what she couldn't access, she was caught unsuspecting and embarrassed. I don't really remember much. There it was, her Alzheimer's, stripped and naked under the fluorescent lighting, on display for Sarah something to scrutinize and judge. That's okay. Tell me what you do remember, anything at all. Well, it was about an airport, I think. Did the story take place on a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday? I don't remember. Just take a guess, then. Monday. Was there a hurricane, a flood, a wildfire, or an avalanche? A wildfire. Did the story take place in April, May, June, or July? July. Which airport was shut down? John Wayne, Dulles, or LAX? LAX. How many travelers were stranded? 30, 40, 50, or 60? I don't know. 60. How many children were stranded? 2, 4, 6, or 8? 8. Who else became stranded? 2 firemen, 2 policemen, 2 businessmen, or 2 teachers? 2 firemen. Great, you're all done here. I'll walk you over to Dr. Davis. Great? Was it possible that she remembered the story but didn't know she knew it? She walked into Dr. Davis's office, surprised to see John already there, sitting in the seat that had remained conspicuously empty on her previous two visits. They were all there now. Alice, John, and Dr. Davis. She couldn't believe that this was really happening, that this was her life, that she was a sick woman at her neurologist's appointment with her husband. She almost felt like a character in a play, this woman with Alzheimer's disease. The husband held his script in his lap. Only it wasn't a script. It was the activities of daily living questionnaire. Interior of doctor's office, the woman's neurologist sits across from the woman's husband. Enter the woman. Alice, have a seat. I've just had a few minutes here with John. John spun his wedding band and jiggled his right leg. Their chairs touched, so he was causing hers to vibrate. What had they been talking about? She wanted to talk to John in private before they began, to find out what had happened and to get their stories straight. And she wanted to ask him to stop shaking her. "How are you?" asked Dr. Davis. "I'm good." He smiled at her. It was a kind smile, and it dulled the edges of her apprehension. "Okay, how about your memory? Are there any additional concerns or changes since the last time you were here?" "Well, I'd say I'm having a harder time keeping track of my schedule. I have to refer to my BlackBerry and to-do lists all day long. And I hate talking on the phone now. If I can't see the person I'm talking to, I have a really hard time understanding the entire conversation. I usually lose track of what the person is saying while I'm chasing down words in my head." "How about disorientation? Any more episodes of feeling lost or confused?" "No. Well, sometimes I get confused as to what time of day it is, even looking at my watch, but I eventually figure it out. I did go to my office once thinking it was morning and didn't realize until I got back home that it was the middle of the night."
"You did?" asked John. "When was this?"
"I don't know. Last month, I think."
"Where was I?"
"Asleep."
"Why am I just finding out about this now, Allie?"
"I don't know. I forgot to tell you." She smiled, but it didn't seem to change him. If anything, the edges of his apprehension got a little sharper. "This type of confusion and night wandering is very common, and it's likely to happen again. You might want to consider attaching a jingle bell to the front door or something that would wake John up if it opened in the middle of the night. And you should probably register with the Alzheimer's Association's Safe Return Program. I think it's something like $40, and you wear an ID bracelet with a personal code on it. I have John programmed into my cell phone, and I carry it with me in this bag at all times."
"Okay, that's good. But what if the battery goes dead or John's phone is off and you're lost?"
"How about a piece of paper in my bag that has my name, John's, our address, and phone numbers?"
"That'll work as long as you always have it on you. You might forget to bring your bag. The bracelet you wouldn't have to think about."
"It's a good idea," said John. "She'll get one."
"How are you doing with the medications? Are you taking all of your doses?"
"Yes."
"Any problems with side effects? Nausea? Dizziness?"
"No."
"Aside from your night at the office, are you having any trouble sleeping?"
"No."
"Are you still getting regular exercise?"
"Yes, I'm still running, about 5 miles, usually every day."
"John, do you run?"
"No, I walk to work and home, that's about it for me."
"I think it'd be a good idea for you to take up running with her. There's convincing data in animal models that suggest exercise alone can slow the accumulation of amyloid beta and cognitive decline."
"I've seen those studies," said Alice.
"Right, so keep up with the running, but I'd like it if you could pair up with a running partner. That way we don't have to worry about you getting lost or skipping your run because you forgot about it."
"I'll start running with her."
John hated running. He played squash and tennis and an occasional game of golf, but he never ran. He could certainly outpace her mentally now, but physically she was still miles ahead of him. She loved the idea of running with him, but doubted that he could commit to it.
"How's your mood been? Are you feeling okay?"
"Generally good. I'm definitely frustrated a lot and exhausted from trying to keep up with everything. and I'm anxious about what lies ahead for us. But otherwise, I feel the same. Better, actually, in some ways, since telling John and the kids. Have you told anyone at Harvard?
No, not yet.
Were you able to teach your classes and meet all of your professional responsibilities this semester?
Yes. It took a lot more out of me than it did last semester, but yes.
Have you been traveling alone to meetings and lectures?
I've pretty much stopped. I canceled 2 university lectures, and I skipped a big conference in April, and I'm missing the one in France this month. I normally travel a lot in the summer, we both do, but this year we're spending the whole summer at our house in Chatham. We're heading down there next month.
Good, that sounds wonderful.
Okay, it sounds like you'll be well taken care of for the summer. I do think you should come up with a plan for the fall that involves telling the people at Harvard, maybe coming up with a way of transitioning out of your job that makes sense. And I think traveling alone should be out of the question at that point.
She nodded. She dreaded September.
There are some legal things to plan now as well, advance directives like power of attorney and a living will. Have you thought about whether or not you'd like to donate your brain to research?
She had thought about it. She imagined her brain, bloodless, formalin-perfused, and silly putty-colored, sitting in the cupped hands of a medical student. The instructor would point to various sulci and gyri, indicating the locations of the somatosensory cortex, the auditory cortex, and the visual cortex. The smell of the ocean, the sounds of her children's voices, John's hands and face. Or she imagined it cut into thin coronal slices, like a deli ham, and adhered to glass slides. In such a preparation, the enlarged ventricles would be striking, the empty spaces where she once resided.
Yes, I'd like to.
John cringed.
Okay, I'll have you fill out the paperwork before you leave.
John, can I have that questionnaire you're holding?
What did he say about me in there?
They would never talk about it.
When did Alice tell you about her diagnosis?
Just after you told her.
Okay, how would you say she's been doing since then?
Very well, I think. It's true about the phone. She won't answer it at all anymore. Either I get it or she lets the machine pick it up. She's become glued to her BlackBerry, almost like a compulsion. Sometimes she checks it every couple of minutes in the morning before she leaves the house. That's a little difficult to watch.
More and more, it seemed he couldn't bear to look at her. When he did, it was with a clinical eye, like she was one of his lab rats.
Anything else? Anything that Alice may not have mentioned?
Nothing I can think of.
How's her mood and personality? Any changes you've noticed there?
No, she's the same.
A little defensive, maybe. And quieter. She doesn't initiate conversation as much.
And how are you doing?
Me? I'm fine.
I have some information for you to take with you about our caregivers' support group. Denise Daddario is the social worker here. You should make an appointment with her and just let her know what's going on.
This is an appointment for me?
Yes.
Really, I don't need one. I'm fine.
Okay, well, these resources are here if you find you come to need them. Now I have some questions for Alice.
Actually, I want to talk about some additional therapies and clinical trials, said John.
Okay, let's do that, but first let's finish up her exam.
Alice, what day of the week is it?
Monday.
And when were you born?
October 11th, 1953.
Who was the Vice President of the United States?
Dick Cheney.
Okay, now I'm going to tell you a name and address, and you're going to repeat it back to me. Then I'm going to ask you to repeat it again later. Ready? John Black, 42 West Street, Brighton.
The same as last time.
Yes, it is. Very good. Can you repeat it back to me now?
John Black, 42 West Street, Brighton.
John Black, 42 West Street, Brighton. John never wears black. Lydia lives out west. Tom lives in Brighton. 8 years ago, I was 42. John Black, 42 West Street, Brighton. Okay, can you count to 20 forwards and then backwards? She did. Now I want you to raise the number of fingers on your left hand, which corresponds to the place in the alphabet of the first letter of the city you're in. She repeated what he said in her head and then made the peace sign with her left index and middle fingers. Good. Now what is this thing called on my watch? A clasp. Okay, now write a sentence about today's weather on this piece of paper. It is hazy, hot, and humid. On the other side of that paper, draw a clock showing the time as 45 minutes past 3. She drew a big circle and filled in the numbers starting at the top with 12. Oops, I made the circle too big. She scribbled it out. 3:45. No, not digital. I'm looking for an analog clock, said Dr. Davis. Well, are you looking to see if I can draw or if I can still tell time? If you draw me a clock face, I can show you 3:45. I've never been any good at drawing. When Anna was 3, she loved horses and used to beg Alice to draw pictures of them for her. Alice's renditions had looked, at best, like postmodern dragon dogs, and always failed to satisfy even the wild and generously accepting imagination of her preschooler. No, Mom, not that. Draw me a horse. I'm actually looking for both, Alice. Alzheimer's affects the parietal lobes pretty early on, and that's where we keep our internal representations of extrapersonal space. John, this is why I want you to go running with her. John nodded. They were ganging up on her. John, you know I can't draw. Alice, it's a clock, not a horse. Stunned that he didn't defend her, she glared at him and raised her eyebrows, giving him a second chance to verify her perfectly valid position. He just stared back at her and spun his ring. If you draw me a clock, I'll show you 3:45. Dr. Davis drew a clock face on a new sheet of paper, and Alice drew the hands pointing to the correct time. Okay, now I'd like you to tell me that name and address I asked you to remember earlier. John Black, something West Street, Brighton. Okay, was it 42, 44, 46, or 48? 48. Dr. Davis wrote something lengthy on the piece of paper with the clock. John, please stop shaking my chair. Okay, now we can talk about clinical trial options. There are several ongoing studies here and at the Brigham. The one I like the most for you starts enrolling patients this month. It's a phase 3 study, and it's a drug called Amylyx. It appears to bind soluble amyloid beta and prevent its aggregation, so unlike the drugs you're on now, there's the hope that this could prevent the disease from progressing further. The phase 2 study was very encouraging. It was well tolerated, and after a year on the medication, the patient's cognitive functioning seemed to have stopped declining or even improved. I assume it's placebo-controlled? Asked John. Yes, it's double-blind and randomized to placebo or one of two doses. So I might get only sugar pills. She suspected that amyloid beta didn't give a shit about placebo effects or the power of wishful thinking. What do you think of the secretase inhibitors? Asked John. John liked these best. Secretases were the naturally occurring enzymes that released normal, unharmful levels of amyloid beta. The mutation in Alice's presenilin-1 secretase rendered it insensitive to proper regulation, and it produced too much amyloid beta. Too much was harmful. Like turning on a faucet that couldn't be turned off, her sink was rapidly overflowing. Right now, the secretase inhibitors are either too toxic for clinical use or... What about Flurazan? Flurazan was an anti-inflammatory drug like Advil. Myriad Pharmaceuticals claimed it decreased the production of amyloid beta 42. Less water into the sink. Yes, there's a lot of attention on that one. There's an ongoing phase 2 study, but only in Canada and the UK. How do you feel about Alice taking flurbiprofen? We don't have any data yet to say whether or not it's effective for treating Alzheimer's. If she decides not to enroll in a clinical trial, I would say it probably couldn't hurt. But if she wants to be in the study, flurbiprofen would be considered an investigational treatment for Alzheimer's, and taking it would exclude her from the study.
All right, what about Alan's monoclonal antibody? Asked John.
I like it, but it's only in phase one, and enrollment is currently closed. Assuming it passes safety, they won't likely initiate phase two until spring of next year at the earliest, and I'd like to get Alice in a trial sooner if we can.
Have you ever put anyone on IVIG therapy? Asked John.
John also liked the idea of this one.
Derived from donated blood plasma, intravenous immunoglobulin was already approved safe and effective for treating primary immune deficiencies and a number of autoimmune neuromuscular disorders. It would be expensive and not reimbursable by their insurance company because of its off-label use, but worth any price if it worked.
I've never had a patient go on it. I'm not against it, but we don't know the proper dosing, and it's a very untargeted and crude method. I wouldn't expect its effects to be anything more than modest.
We'll take modest, said John.
Okay, but you need to understand what you'd be trading off. If you decide to go ahead with IVIG therapy, Alice wouldn't be eligible for any of these clinical trials with treatments that are potentially more specific and disease-modifying.
But she'd be guaranteed not to be in a placebo group.
That's true. There are risks with either decision.
Would I have to go off the Aricept and Namenda to participate in the clinical trial?
No, you'd keep taking them.
Could I go on estrogen replacement therapy?
Yes. There's enough anecdotal evidence to suggest that it's at least to some degree protective, so I'd be willing to write you a prescription for CombiPatch. But again, it would be considered an investigational drug, and you wouldn't be able to participate in the Amylyx trial.
How long would I be in the trial for?
It's a 15-month study.
What's your wife's name? Asked Alice.
Lucy.
What would you want Lucy to do if she had this?
I'd want her to enroll in the Amylyx trial.
So Amylyx is the only option you can recommend? Asked John.
Yes.
I think we should do the IVIG along with flurbiprofen and the CombiPatch, said John.
The room became still and quiet.
An enormous amount of information had just been passed back and forth.
Alice pressed her fingers on her eyes and tried to think analytically about her treatment options. She did her best to set up columns and rows in her head to compare the drugs, but the imaginary chart didn't help, and she tossed it into the imaginary trash. She thought conceptually instead and arrived at a single, crisp image that made sense. A shotgun or a single bullet.
You don't need to make a decision on this today. You can go home and think about it some more and get back to me.
No, she didn't need to think about it any further. She was a scientist. She knew how to risk everything, with no guarantees, in search of the unknown truth. As she'd done so many times over the years with her own research, she chose the bullet.
I want to do the trial.
Allie, I think you should trust me here, said John.
I can still draw my own conclusions, John. I want to do the trial.
Okay, I'll get you the forms to sign.
Interior of doctor's office. The neurologist left the room. The husband spun his ring. The woman hoped for a cure. July 2004. John? John, are you home?
She was sure that he wasn't, but being sure of anything these days was tattered with too many holes to contain the meaning that it used to. He'd left to go somewhere, but she couldn't remember when he left or where he was going. Did he run to the store for milk or coffee? Did he go out to rent a movie? If either were the case, he'd be back any minute. Or did he drive back up to Cambridge, in which case he'd be gone for at least several hours and possibly the night? Or did he decide, at last, that he couldn't face what lay ahead for them, and he just plain left, never to return? No, he wouldn't do that. She was sure of it. Their Chatham Cape, built in 1990, felt bigger, more open and less compartmentalized than their house in Cambridge. She walked into the kitchen. It was nothing like their kitchen at home. The bleached effect of the white-painted walls and cabinets, white appliances, white bar stools, and white tile floor was broken up only slightly by the soapstone countertops and splashes of cobalt blue in various white ceramic and clear glass containers. It looked like a coloring book page that had been only tentatively filled in with a single blue crayon. The two plates and used paper napkins on the island counter displayed evidence of salad and a spaghetti and red sauce dinner. One of the glasses still held a gulp of white wine. With the detached curiosity of a forensic scientist, she picked up the glass and tested the temperature of the wine against her lips. It was still a little cold. She felt full. She looked at the time. It was just after 9 o'clock. They'd been in Chatham for a week now. In years past, after a week away from the day-to-day concerns at Harvard, she would have been fully committed to the relaxed lifestyle that the Cape insisted on and already deep into her third or fourth book. But this year, Harvard's day-to-day schedule itself, albeit packed and demanding, had provided a structure for her that was familiar and comforting. Meetings, symposia, class times, and appointments lay like breadcrumbs that guided her through each day. Here in Chatham, she had no schedule. She slept late, ate meals at varying times, and played everything by ear. She bookended each day with her medications, she took her butterfly test each morning, and she ran every day with John. But these didn't provide enough structure. She needed bigger breadcrumbs, and more of them. She often didn't know the time of day, or what day it was, for that matter. On more than one occasion now, when she sat down to eat, she didn't know which meal she was about to be presented with. When yesterday a waitress at the sandbar put a plate of fried clams in front of her, she would have just as readily and enthusiastically dug into a plate of pancakes. The kitchen windows were open. She looked out into the driveway. No car. The outside air still held traces of the hot day and carried sounds of bullfrogs, a woman laughing, and the tide at Harding's Beach. She left a note for John next to the uncleared dishes. Walk to beach, love A. She inhaled the clean night air. The midnight blue sky was punctured with backlit stars and a cartoon crescent moon. Not as dark as it would get that night, it was already darker than it ever got in Cambridge. Without street lamps and tucked far enough in from Main Street, only lights from porches, rooms and houses, the occasional car-high beams, and the moon illuminated their beach neighborhood. In Cambridge, that amount of darkness would have made her feel uneasy walking alone, but here, in this small seaside and vacationing community, she felt perfectly safe. There were no cars parked in the lot and no one else on the beach. The town police discouraged activity there at night. At this hour, there were no screaming children or seagulls, no impossible-to-ignore cell phone conversations, no aggressive worries about needing to leave in time to get to the next thing, nothing to disrupt the peace. She walked to the water's edge and let the ocean consume her feet. Warm waves licked her legs. Facing Nantucket Sound, Harding's Beach's protected waters were a good 10 degrees milder than those of the nearby beaches that faced the cold Atlantic directly. She removed her shirt and bra first, then slid off her skirt and underwear in one motion and walked in. The water, free from the seaweed that normally tumbled in with the surf, lapped milky smooth against her skin. She began to breathe to the rhythm of the tide. As she treaded lightly, floating on her back, she marveled at the beads of phosphorescence that trailed her fingertips and heels like pixie dust. Moonlight reflected off her right wrist. Safe Return was engraved on the front of the flat, 2-inch stainless steel bracelet. A 1-800 number, her identification, and the words, "Memory Impaired," were etched on the reverse side. Her thoughts then rode a series of waves, traveling from unwanted jewelry to her mother's butterfly necklace, traversing from there to her plan for suicide, to the books she planned to read, and finally stranded themselves on the common fates of Virginia Woolf and Edna Pontellier. It would be so easy. She could swim straight out toward Nantucket until she was too tired to continue. She looked out over the dark water. Her body, strong and healthy, held her buoyant, treading water, every instinct battling toward life. Yes, she didn't remember eating dinner with John tonight, or where he'd said he was going. And she might very well not remember this night in the morning. But in this moment, she didn't feel desperate. She felt alive and happy. She looked back toward the beach, the landscape dimly lit. A figure approached. She knew it was John before she could identify any of his features by the bounce and size of his walk. She didn't ask him where he'd been or how long he'd been gone. She didn't thank him for coming back. He didn't scold her for being out alone without her cell phone, and he didn't ask her to get out and come home. Without a word between them, he undressed and joined her in her ocean. John? She found him painting the trim on the detached garage. I've been calling for you all over the house, said Alice. I was out here. I didn't hear you, said John. When do you leave for the conference? She asked. Monday. He was going to Philadelphia for a week to attend the 9th International Conference on Alzheimer's Disease. That's after Lydia gets here, right? Yes, she'll be here on Sunday. Oh, right. Following Lydia's written request, the Monomoy Theater Repertory Company had invited her to join them as a guest artist for the summer. Are you ready to run? Asked John. The early morning fog hadn't yet lifted, and the air felt cooler than she'd dressed for. I just need to grab another layer. Inside the front door, she opened the coat closet. Dressing comfortably on the Cape in early summer posed a constant challenge, with temperatures on any given day beginning in the 50s, soaring up to 80 by afternoon, and boomeranging back down into the 50s, often paired with a brisk ocean wind by nightfall. It required a creative sense of fashion and a willingness to add and subtract articles of clothing many times a day. She touched the sleeves of each of the hanging coats. Although a number of them would be perfect now for sitting or walking on the beach, everything in there felt too heavy for running. She ran up the stairs and into their bedroom. After searching through several drawers, she found a lightweight fleece and put it on. She noticed the book she'd been reading on her nightstand. She grabbed it and walked down the stairs and into the kitchen. She poured herself a glass of iced tea and walked out to the back porch. The early morning fog hadn't yet lifted, and it was cooler than she'd anticipated. She set her drink and book down on the table between the white Adirondack chairs and went back into the house to retrieve a blanket. She returned, wrapped herself in the blanket, sat in one of the chairs, and opened her book to the dog-eared page. Reading was fast becoming a heartbreaking chore. She had to reread pages over and over to retain the continuity of the thesis or narrative, and if she put the book down for any length of time, she had to go back, sometimes a full chapter, to find the thread again. Plus, she felt anxious over deciding what to read. What if she didn't have time to read everything she'd always wanted to? Prioritizing hurt, a reminder that the clock was ticking, that some things would be left undone. She'd just begun reading King Lear. She so loved Shakespeare's tragedies, but had never read this one. Unfortunately, as was becoming routine, she found herself stuck after only a few minutes. She reread the previous page, tracing the imaginary line below the words with her index finger. She drank the entire glass of iced tea and watched the birds in the trees. "There you are. What are you doing? Aren't we going for a run?" John asked. "Oh, yes, good. This book is making me crazy. Let's go, then. Are you going to that conference today?" "Monday. What's today?" "Thursday. Oh, and when does Lydia get here?" "Sunday. That's before you leave?" Yes, Allie, I just told you all this. You should put it in your BlackBerry. I think it'd make you feel better.
Okay. Sorry.
Ready?
Yes.
Wait, let me pee before we go.
All right, I'll be out by the garage.
She placed her empty glass on the counter next to the sink and dropped the blanket and book on the slip-covered